You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory. All right, Dave Silver, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, this is great. So you're a physician.
Yes.
And you're at the VA downtown Indianapolis.
Correct.
What's your role there?
I am chief of staff. I've been in that role for about 2.5 years. And just disclaimer, I'm not really going to be speaking officially as someone from the VA, but just my own personal perspective on things.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I don't think anyone's going to hold the VA to whatever you say. But that's good. I'm glad you made that. So what does a chief of staff do at the VA?
We're basically in charge of clinical operations, Dave. We make sure that all the clinical folks are coordinating operations in the clinic well. We have staffing that we need. Our processes and procedures are in place, and just overall that things are working well. We have a clinical nurse that is the other major clinical executive, and then we have administrative people that also work with us.
So your day-to-day stuff is probably a lot of meetings, I'm guessing.
Correct.
A lot of emails.
Yeah, and I still talk with patients quite a bit. I still see patients, not as much as I used to, about a half day a week now, as opposed to every day, which I did for many years. And so I still do that, and I still talk with patients, deal sometimes with problems, sometimes encourage people, and just make the rounds and make sure the troops are doing well.
That's cool. When you're seeing patients, are you following a certain kind of patient, or is it just general medicine, or what?
I'm a general internist, primary care doc. I've been doing that for over 30 years.
Wow.
Next year, it'll be 40 years since I started med school.
Oh, wow.
So we have a lot of years of training.
That's cool.
Between med school and residency. Yeah, so I've been doing it for a while, and I still enjoy it. And
Yeah. That's awesome. So in the VA, you're probably seeing some tough stuff, I'm guessing. What is the overall tenor of working in the VA right now? Is morale high? Is morale low? Do you feel like are people discouraged by different things? Like, what's the culture like right now in the VA?
I think the morale is good. Like everybody else, we're reeling from COVID still.
Still, really?
Even though we're back on our feet, we're not wearing masks as routinely as we were. We still are in a lot of the hospital clinical areas and things like that. But in general, I think because we're the largest healthcare organization in the country, we're a big network that works together well. We have regional facilities. We have over 150 facilities and 18 visions or regional areas. And so I think we're not alone. We talk with each other. We're always growing. We're a high reliability organization. We're always trying to improve quality. And this is what I like about the VA. I've been here about half my career, a little bit more than half in community health. And the VA is really focused on quality, doing a good job with each patient. Whereas some outside organizations are, they're for profit. They're trying to make sure financially they survive. Not that we ignore finances. We try to be very good stewards of our resources, but we're really, our goal is to honor the veteran by taking good care of them, and we really focus on quality. And we don't have to worry quite as much on the financial side. So
yeah. So what's one thing that you think has been enjoyable for you as a physician working in the VA? Where do you find a lot of what do you get a lot of personal fulfillment out of?
I think it was, when I worked, I was a chief medical officer outside the VA in a nonprofit community health company. And there, again, as an executive, I didn't have a team in place the way I do now. So I was running all over the place, working more hours than I am now. A lot of it was because I didn't have a good team. And then as a frontline clinician, they would double, triple book me. I would see close to 30 complicated geriatric patients a day. I worked in a special Medicare center. Then I went over to the VA back when I was in Baltimore, and I was like, wow, I have an hour for a new patient, a half hour for an established patient. Yeah. They don't double book me. unless I want to slip somebody in. Mm-hmm. So I felt like a consultant, really, mm-hmm. even though I was a primary care doctor. And really, the whole time I've been at the VA for about 14 years, I really feel like I have time to get to know people, to really do a quality job. I'm not as hard-pressed for the productivity. So I think, to me, that's been the greatest joy. And then becoming a leader eventually here in Indianapolis, I was chief of primary care for a number of years, and realized, you know what, it's better to be a leader in a place where you have some support, you have a good team, and then just without really trying, the opportunity came, you know, to take this role. And so eventually, you know, I've done that, and I think, you know, I'm more toward the end of my career.
Sure.
So I think it's a good way to end it.
Yeah, I think so too. And as a grateful citizen, thank you for taking care of our vets, our veterans. I really appreciate that. Speak to me about the patients you're seeing. You know, what's it like taking care of veterans? I mean, that's different than other forms of medicine where, you know, they may not have had battlefield wounds, et cetera. But like, what's it like taking care of people that have served their country?
Well, one thing I realized that was a good fit for me is it seemed like all the areas that I really enjoyed in medicine was there. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I really liked men's health. Like, you know, dealing with prostate issues. I don't know why, but I always have.
Okay.
Kind of like just the idea of men's health. Some people like women's health better.
Sure.
But I always kind of favored.
As a man, thank you.
Yeah, I just always favored
people,
men's health.
Yeah.
And then also, I also always had an interest in chronic pain, and that's certainly something that we see.
Yeah.
Also, mental health issues, not only in my own family did I have to deal with it, but over many years, you find out in primary care, it's a lot of mental health. About 70% of primary care visits, there's some mental health issue or some chronic problem that needs to be addressed by mental health. So if you put all those things together, really, almost all the areas of interest I found. The VA is growing their women's population, but still in some places, 90% men. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of chronic pain. We deal with a lot of post-traumatic stress disorders and mental illness, probably a higher percentage of people that are vulnerable to suicide. And so I fit right in. You know, community health, you deal with uninsured people with a lot of chronic complications. And I was working in a geriatric center. To me, the patient population wasn't really that much different, except just a little more emphasis on those things that I happen to have an interest in.
Mm-hmm. What's it like being a Christian working in, not just in the medical field, but in particular for a government-run medical facility? You know, I'm sure you've run up against either conflicting ideas or, you know, persecution or whatever, but what's it like being a Christian in your field?
Well, to me, it is not that much different from what I was doing before, in that when I was in community health, we had fellowship groups, you know, after hours. Mm-hmm. And at the VA, at times, I've been at places where we had fellowship groups either during lunch or after hours. And so I was involved no matter where I was. I tended to be involved with those. Just today, there was a meeting that really encouraged me. There was a group of chaplains and mental health people that had a little one day, or it wasn't even one day, really it was a 1-hour seminar. And I think it's going to be an ongoing series. But they were just talking openly about spiritual issues. And at times I felt like you do have to be a little more discreet in some ways in the workplace. And in federal service, we talk about diversity, but sometimes if you bring up spirituality in open forum, sometimes people change the subject right away, but not in this meeting today. So I was writing in the chat, I am so glad we're talking openly about this. And sometimes, though we claim to be diverse and open, sometimes we're not as open. But, you know, living the life in the workplace, no matter where you are, I think you always have to use discretion. You have to be gracious and kind to people. You have to have a balance of doing what is right, sometimes being firm when you need to be, but doing it in a way that is gracious and kind. And so in that sense, you know, it may be a little different than a private practice where you're telling everyone what to do. The VA or even community health is a more level playing field, and you have to be more of a servant, not just, if you start ordering people, they're going to ask you to go somewhere else. So in that sense, I've only worked in the nonprofit sector and now the federal service for half my career, and I like that kind of atmosphere.
Is it such that you have to watch what you're saying to the point of not being able to, let's say, pray with a patient? I know like some physicians ask at the end, you know, could I pray with you or pray for you? You know, we hear all the stories about getting God out of schools mm-hmm. and things like that. And is it similar? Are you allowed to go into that area with people, or do you have to kind of just
yeah, play it safe? And again, I don't think being, you know, working for the government is any different than anywhere else. I think my tendency that I developed over years is I tend to deal with the medical issues that they're coming to me with, mm-hmm. develop a relationship, and then a lot of times spiritual issues would come up because of what they're dealing with mm-hmm. or because it's part of their culture and it's important to them. Mm-hmm. Someone that is not sensitive to spiritual issues, they may change the subject, even a mm-hmm. provider, but I tend not to. I tend to draw them out. Mm-hmm. Usually we won't do anything without the permission of a patient, whether it's praying right. or talking about spiritual things. But over many years, as I've gotten to know patients, a lot of times they will bring it up mm-hmm. and say, would you pray for me? Oh, wow. Or what do you think about this? I had one patient many years ago, and this was in community health. I walked in the room, and the first thing he said to me was, I think I'm going to hell.
Well,
can you help me with that? I said, we can talk about it, yes.
Yeah.
And so I think there's been opportunities, and I think it depends on the clinician as to how sensitive they are mm-hmm. in developing their own style of doing that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think there's opportunities. And I just think you have to be sensitive and be wise, be winsome.
Yeah. Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. The verse comes to mind.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you say, you know, you've been talking with people, or you talk with people about spiritual things, depending on what they're coming into the clinic for. Have you seen an uptick of that type of conversation since the mental health crisis has been on the rise and things like that? Have people been more open to spiritual matters since mental health issues has kind of come to the forefront?
In some ways, yes, because I think with mental health patients, they tend to be sometimes more open to spiritual things mm-hmm. because of their neediness mm-hmm. and because, you know, how do you separate out the physical?
Yeah.
Mental, emotional, and spiritual.
Yeah, we're whole beings.
Yeah, it's hard to dichotomize. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think there is sometimes more an openness. And then again, sometimes people will say things and you have to take it with a grain of salt, depending on what kind of mental illness. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with quite a few people that were schizophrenia mm-hmm. and their thinking may not be as somebody that doesn't have something like that. And so you have to, there can be religiosity and talking about spiritual things in a way that doesn't make sense. So I think you kind of take that in mind and you look at the context and try to be appropriate.
Do you think that your clinic has seen more mental health patients because it's on the rise, or do you think it's because it's been less stigmatized that people are coming in to actually get treatment for it?
I mean, there is still some stigma there, but I think because we're used to dealing with this definitely at the VA and even in community health, we had a big emphasis on mental health. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of uninsured and homeless people. So I think there's still a stigma there, but as you develop the relationship, as you deal with the barriers to why sometimes in primary care, sometimes people will say, I don't want to see a psychologist. I don't want to see a psychiatrist. And then sometimes we'll take it. We can treat initially depression or anxiety, but if we see someone's not doing well, often we'll say, well, what are you concerned about? Nobody's going to know. Everything's confidential. They're right. In fact, I can walk you right down to the hall to have someone start the conversation. Mm-hmm. We have primary care mental health integration. Mm-hmm. So they're there right in the clinic with us. We'll have a psychologist or two. And so we've had that for a number of years as well. And so I think that's helped kind of bridge the gap a little.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you said that you're still kind of reeling from COVID a little bit. Do you think that mental health has changed significantly since the COVID era and like, was it affected by that?
It's definitely, there's definitely an increase of people with mental health problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think for people that were isolated, I don't think that was good for people's emotional health and sometimes physical health as
sure.
well. Sometimes people were waiting until things were really in crisis, you know.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of people coming in. Of course, people with COVID in the beginning, there was a higher percentage of people dying. Not as many now, but still mm-hmm. we have serious cases of COVID. Mm-hmm. But I think, yeah, there's definitely kind of a panic that set in. And even though it's settled down some, there's this underlying, we've had to do more virtual visits because sometimes people don't want to be around a bunch of other people, mm-hmm. especially if they have to travel a long distance. Mm-hmm. So we've had to adjust just like the rest of the world to telehealth, virtual modalities, mm-hmm. having meetings even sometimes virtually. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I would say now we have sometimes meetings with 100, 150 people in it that might have been 30 or 40 or 50 before because of the ease of doing that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's pluses and minuses. I'm a little more old-fashioned. I kind of like being face-to-face with people.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
So most of my patients still come in face-to-face. Occasionally, I'll do a virtual visit or even a phone call. Yeah. But I still try to, or I'll say to them, all right, we're doing a virtual visit, but I need to lay my hands on you next time.
Mm-hmm.
So within a year, I want to at least see you once and so I can really examine you the right way.
Yeah. You need to be able to do a good history and physical in person, not just online. Yeah, that's cool. One reason I asked particularly about the mental health thing is because since COVID at the church here, we have lots of requests for counseling and, a listening ear and prayer and things like that, which we welcome. We're like, yes, if this is something you're struggling with, we want to be able to, we're here to help. I mean, that's part of the job. And we've seen an increase in that in the last few years significantly. Yeah. Such that we regularly point people to professional counselors or sit and pray and talk with people as well. I think that corresponds to what we are seeing probably in the medical field as well.
I would think so, yeah.
So tell me how you got into this. Like, what's the Dave Silver origin story of going into medicine?
Well, for me, becoming a doctor and becoming a Christian were almost simultaneous.
You're going to have to tease that out. I'm curious now.
Yeah. Well, I'm from a Jewish background.
Yes.
And there is a movie that my twin brother put together called Silver Twins.
Silver Twins, folks.
Don't put a "the" in there or you won't find it, but just Silver Twins. It's on YouTube now under a Christian company, and it has also been on Amazon Prime for a number of years.
Okay.
Well, my brother, he tells the story of how these two stubborn Jewish twins came to the Lord really through supernatural means.
So you said Jewish. Now, were you raised, was it culturally Jewish, religiously Jewish? Like, what was the background there?
Yeah, we were Reformed Jews, which doesn't mean the same thing as it does in Christianity.
Right.
Reformed Jews is pretty much secular.
Yeah.
And there's conservative Jews, there's Orthodox Jews. My grandparents were conservative, and then it got watered down with the next following generations.
Sure.
And I grew up in an all mostly Jewish neighborhood in Philadelphia. And eventually, when I was about 8 years old, we moved across the river to New Jersey, mm-hmm. where there wasn't as many synagogues. And so we dropped out, three of us, before we got bar mitzvah, out of the four of us. And my mom started looking into other religions, Baha'i faith, Unitarian, different things. Mm-hmm. Not so much Christianity, but by the time we went to college, my twin brother and I started coming across Christians, looking mm-hmm. into it, going to Bible studies. So we both came, and then, of course, we both started really seeking the Lord. We both had dreams.
Okay,
where Christ came to us. And so in my junior year of college, back in about 82, we both came to the Lord, and it was just brand new for us. Well, at the time, I wasn't doing very well in school, and I thought I'd wanted to go to med school. I had since I was young, but you know, if you go three semesters in a row without breaking a 3.0, you might as well give up.
Yeah.
But I just prayed and said, Lord, do you really want me to be a doctor?
Yeah.
And not in any audible voice, but I sensed within me the Spirit say, yes, but not for the reasons you had or what you were thinking, but for my reasons and for my glory.
Okay.
I said, okay.
What were your reasons? I mean, was it financial or?
You know, I was a secular Jew. I just thought, I'll make good money. This will be a nice life. It was all about me.
Okay.
And not so much being, you know, going in and having more honorable reasons as we would as a Christian, because the Lord has called us to serve, to help people, to minister to people. But by the time I went to med school, and the Lord was able to get me in, and by the way, then I made dean's list the rest of college as soon as I became a Christian, because my priorities straightened up.
Yeah.
I broke off a relationship with a girlfriend that was bogging me down.
That's bound to help your grades.
That helped my grades right there.
Yeah.
Started studying, and then I was able to, you know, people that were kind and gracious were willing to see that my slope went up and I was getting better, and they said, what happened? And I shared with them, and they were like, okay, we believe you.
I had a buddy in college that had the same thing happen. He was already a believer, but he was studying for his exams for like 3 or 4 hours a night. Mm-hmm. at Barnes & Noble with his girlfriend. And I'm like, you're not studying. That doesn't constitute studying. You need to not be at Barnes & Noble, probably not with your girlfriend, and just at a desk with a book for 2 hours. And he's like, all right, fine, I'll give it a try. And when he did, he realized, oh, yeah, I wasn't studying. And his grades went up.
Yeah.
Of course, he got married before I did, so maybe he was on the right track. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, right before I went to college, my mom left us, and I was, you know, my family was very important to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of friends, and so I kind of went to college angry, confused, upset, distracted, and that didn't bode well. As time went on, it really was not heading in a positive direction. So the Lord turned me around, got me into med school, and then when I went there, really the crisis was, Lord, I really want to be a minister. I really want to learn your word. And
Is how many years out from being becoming a believer?
About a year and a half. So I went to med school, and I had this strong inclination, like, I want to really learn your word. I didn't know that I wanted to be a pastor, but I just said, I want to be a minister of the gospel. Okay. It's changed my life. I want to help other people. And again, that inclination within was, you are a minister. You'll be a medical minister. And someday you will go to seminary.
Okay.
As soon as you get out of debt.
Yeah, you got to pay off that med school. pay for another school.
Right?
Yeah.
So that is what happened over time. I went out into practice. Of course, I met somebody else in med school who was a Christian. We got married, had 4 children. We were ministering in church, ministering to young couples. She had decided to just stay home with the kids and not continue in medicine, which was fine. And over time, I realized, this is a ministry, but I can also continue to learn and grow outside. Well, by the time I hit my late 30s, I was out of debt. Mm-hmm. And I thought, Lord, someday, I mean, I'll continue being a doctor, but someday I do want to teach the Bible. Mm-hmm. I was starting to learn that I love the Bible, and somehow my background as a doctor helped me to have a perspective that allowed me to teach it in a practical way. Mm-hmm. I found out over time. In fact, it's crazy. Sometimes I think I became a doctor so that I would learn how to teach the Bible.
Interesting.
Not that being a doctor is not important, but, you know, there's different seasons and different stepping stones. And what does a doctor do? I mean, the Latin word for doctor means teacher. Mm. And they take all this literature, and they have a layperson in front of them that they're trying to help with that literature. So they have to break it down in a real easy way. Well, what does a Bible teacher do? He studies all the books, the commentaries, he gets all the theology classes, and then he tries using a language that the layperson can understand to grow in spiritually and, you know, to help him in a practical way. So,
and that used to be what we called the theologians. I mean, they were doctors of the church, right? I mean, that was important to have that title, where you're digesting all this information and helping the people that need help.
So over time, what happened was my wife developed an incurable disease along the way. By about the time we found out after the third child.
Wow.
Because she had some abnormal labs. And then after the fourth child, she had a second autoimmune disease that was incurable.
Oh, my.
So then we were thinking, well, you know, what's going on here? And so we went through a lot of trials. We had some mental illness among our own family. And so the Lord took us through some school of hard knocks. And right around that time, I thought, if I don't go to seminary now, I'm never going to have the strength. At least my wife was functioning pretty well.
Okay.
So on and off, while I was working full-time and became a caretaker of my wife, I went to seminary just one class at a time for about 7 years.
Yeah.
I never even finished, but I came close. But my wife ended up in hospice, and I was an executive by that point.
Yeah.
And I realized I can't do this. So I started auditing classes, and I learned the rest of the Bible without getting credit. Yeah. I really have the equivalent of a master's, but I didn't get credit
for it.
Sure, yeah. Anyway, I decided to, you know, switch jobs from an executive, and I went to the VA on the front lines, a 40-hour-a-week job, so I could get home and take care of my wife, and I just kept studying on the side.
Yeah.
And so that's how I eventually lost my wife, and then I moved to Indiana to get remarried, and I thought, okay, well, now I can transition the ministry when I get enough years in and I'm ready to retire. Then I could use all that seminary training and go to my next career.
I've told you the story before about B.B. Warfield and his and the great Princeton theologian, and how they were on their honeymoon, and his wife was tragically injured, they think during a lightning storm, and he basically became a caretaker for the rest of his life. There are some variations of that story, but the idea is that it wasn't life that they the life that they expected, And he took care of her until she passed. And sometimes that's what God calls people to. And that's hard, but, you know, that's what the vows mean in sickness and in health.
Yes. So what happened, it was B.B. Warfield that, thanks for reminding me of that. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called The Person and Work of Christ, which I had to read in seminary.
Light reading.
Yeah, light reading.
A couple pages.
Right. And in the end, he tacked on a sermon from Philippians 2, which the book of Philippians became a very important book to me.
Sure.
Well, I was studying that, and it was really focused on the fact that Christ made himself nothing, what it meant to be selfless. And so he fleshes that out in the sermon, and he, toward the end of the sermon, as he's getting practical, he says, we're not called to live one life, but 1,000 lives through the lives of 1,000 people that we were meant to network with. Wow. And so when I read that, I was convicted. And I had been a frontline clinician for about 12 years. I was convicted, maybe I should take risks. Maybe I should reach out and really try to be a leader. And so there was a need. We needed a medical director where I was working in our large flagship center. And
this was before the VA. This was still in the private VA. Hospital work.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I became a medical director because there was a need, and I was convicted that I should take some chances. So I did that for a number of years, and then we had no chief medical officer, and I said, okay, I'm willing to do that. And so I did that also for a while, and then but I went back to the VA as a frontline clinician. But I had that experience, and I had kind of that idea that if I ever need to step up and serve, I'm willing. So
what did that, just let me park there for a second, but what was that like to process taking risks at that point in your career? And you directly linked it to your faith.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big deal, because usually we take risks because there's financial gain or you know, I think this is going to work out. But you were doing it for a more spiritual reason or a spiritual reason that you felt like God wanted you in these specific places. I'm assuming that stretched your faith and challenged you.
Yeah, and I mean, because my wife was getting sicker, I was questioning my own logic. Like, now I'm going to work longer hours. And I'm a caretaker and I have a sick wife at home. Lord, do you want me to do this? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just meant other things. I had to say no to a lot of other things that might have been good things, but not the best thing. So I was able to do those kind of positions and take care of my wife and just study in my own spare time. And, you know, maybe I didn't do a lot of other things, but I did what I was called to do. And even when I moved to Indianapolis, I was kind of just trying to mind my own business. Well, there was a need for a leader in primary care. They asked me to do it. I said, I'm not interested. I just was a widower, just got remarried. I just moved here.
Yeah.
They said, but we want somebody who has VA experience, but also has some outside leadership experience. I said, all right, well, I'm qualified, but. So somebody said, well, talk to your wife about it. So, and my wife didn't, she knew about some of the history, but she didn't really know what it was like to be married to a doctor that was busy.
Right.
So I went back home and I said, you know, they're asking if I want to be chief of primary care. And I told her what it was like to be an executive, the long hours and all these emails. Sometimes I didn't get to them until late at night. And I said, you know, we just got married. You wouldn't see me that much. She said, it's okay. I said, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm trying to talk you out of this. But she had more insights. She could see past, you know, my concerns and my not willingness to take a risk.
Yeah.
And so she said, well, just pray about it. And after about a month or so, I started realizing, wait a second now. Remember the lessons the Lord taught you. You know, you've gone through a lot, but you're in a new place. And, you know, I knew I only had a certain number of years left. So I took that job, and then eventually that's how I ended up also in the chief of staff role.
I wrote this essay once. As you know, my wife's in medicine, right? So the essay was called Marrying into Medicine. And there's something about when you marry into medicine, there's this, the medical field has a gravity to it. It just, it pulls everything into its orbit and kind of bends it to its will, whether it's hours or stress or whatever it is. It's just, there's something about it. I think I have to go back and read the essay that I wrote, but I think a lot of it has to do with the importance that the medical field is in society. I mean, you have people that need what you have to offer. And just, I think that would probably apply to people in the ministry as well.
Right.
There's a gravity there that it's like, well, you know, you can't control when someone passes or when someone has a crisis that they need you for. So it has a gravity that pulls the family towards it.
Yes. There's a lot of similarities. So when I changed careers, you know, I'll be helping people with their spiritual needs instead of physical needs as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about that then. You've brought it up. You're coming up on retirement here soon. Mm-hmm. How many years did you say?
Less than a year and a half.
Less than a year and a half. Yeah. All right. So you're, instead of unpacking the golf clubs, you're focused on going into full-time ministry.
Yes.
Describe what you hope that to look like, and not peg, you know, sure, holding you to anything, but what your hopes and dreams are for that next phase.
Well, when my wife was on hospice, you know, and I got most of the seminary training I thought I was going to get, I started a ministry called Transformation Bible Ministries. And if you just tack .org on the end of that, you'll see our website. But the idea, and I got some of this when I was in seminary, because I started seeing resources that listed very good commentaries, 5-star commentaries, and I started reading some of them, and I thought, you know, the average layperson, they don't have time to read a 500 or 1,000-page scholastic commentary, mm-hmm, let alone, and of course, I learned Greek and Hebrew. So even though I don't consider myself a scholar, I could follow them.
Right.
And so I went into the church that I was at the time. I just started asking questions and trying to get to application. Because, you know, even the epistles are about 30 to 50% application, mm-hmm, if you look at the Pauline epistles. But a lot of times we'll share for a long time, and then in the last 1 minute we'll mention something. It's because we're not being intentional to make it practical and to get to application sometimes.
And if I can interject, I think in our cultures we often are very, you know, brains on a stick, right? We think we're just brains, right? Instead of, we actually have to implement what this theology is talking about.
So. Or sometimes people just want to be spoon-fed. We're in that kind of generation. Don't ask me a question, ask me to interact or think. Mm-hmm. But we know people learn better if they interact, mm-hmm, if they have to work through a question. And I don't really, so my philosophy was I can do some of the background work for them. I can write a study guide on a book of the Bible. In fact, I want to do it on all the books of the Bible.
Okay.
So I started doing that back then. I'm only on number 10. And I realized I'm going to have to retire to get some work done.
Yeah. I love it.
But the bottom line is, my study guides are not commentaries. They're short. They get immediately into content so people understand a little bit of background, mm-hmm, and even get into application pretty quickly. So rather than, let's just take the book of Ruth as an example, because that was the first short one that I did. Actually, I did Revelation first.
Oh, that was the easy one.
Yeah, I did it because I figured if I can do it with Revelation, I could do the rest of the Bible.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's good.
And I sent it to... I did send it to Diane and Vern Poitras, knowing that he was a pretty well-known Revelation scholar.
He is.
And I said, would you use this? And anyway, his wife, who had mentored my late wife, she said, yeah, this is really helpful. Like, that's even good. For my husband, it will help him teach lay people. So I thought, okay, well maybe I'm on the
pretty good endorsement
track.
Right there.
Yeah, so I was encouraged by that. And so,
how did you know the Poitras's? I'm sorry, I don't know if I know that story.
My wife went to Westminster.
Okay.
And she became good friends with Diane even before she married Vern.
Oh, wow.
So
okay, interesting.
She mentored my wife for many years, all the way till she died, although from a distance for the last 20 years.
Sure.
But
you went to RTS DC.
Correct.
For seminary, and she went to Westminster. Okay, I'm getting
correct,
it. Good.
Yes. So, but once I did a smaller book like Ruth, you know, the tendency would be to just spend the whole time on background and that kind of thing. What I do is, like for chapter one, which once you have a good understanding, the whole rest of the book flows. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what is the significance of Naomi leaving Bethlehem?
Mm.
And you say, but see, to really understand the book, unless you understand the book, you really can't ask the right question.
Mm-hmm.
You could do what I call the default mode. All right, let's read verse 1. What does that say? Okay, mm-hmm, let's go to verse 2. Okay, let's go to verse 3.
Yeah, running commentary. Yeah.
I don't really think. I mean, that's one way of doing it. But like, remember in the book of Ezra, when the Israelites got together and they had revival and they were getting into the Word of God, they would read the whole Old Testament in like 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would tend to read a whole book in one sitting and then talk about it.
Yeah, the verse-by-verse thing is, I think, kind of a product of the Enlightenment. I think it has some good things, but we kind of think that, if I just zoom in on this microscope a little bit more, then I'm going to get the meaning, right?
Right.
And then in the last, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 years, we've zoomed out a little bit and said, oh, no, this is a legitimate piece of literature. I need to treat it as such.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being a doctor and thinking in a very practical way, I would say ask one question to get them into the text, because the word return or shuv in Hebrew is there over 10 times mm-hmm. in chapter one. It's the key word.
Yeah.
It's not cool. just a physical return, it's a spiritual return. Mm-hmm. And when she goes back, she's not quite the same as she was when she left, but Ruth is different. Mm-hmm. Ruth is there. She's going to end up, she pronounces a curse on herself, or what I call a self-maledictory oath. If I ever leave you, that kind of a curse. Mm-hmm. Or the people of God, or God himself, may he kill me. Mm-hmm. And so then the practical question is, if this young, probably new convert, or at least, you know, it wasn't more than probably a few years that she had come to know the Lord from Moab, if she commits her whole life like that mm-hmm. and ends up really being the heroine of the book, we know she ends up being the great-grandmother of King David, but
yeah,
because the book was really an apologetic to the line of David. But mm-hmm. so I say, if Ruth makes that kind of commitment, what kind of commitment as a Christian can you make with your life? Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to spend, you end up, to answer the first question, you have to get into the background, but you're also going to get into the content of chapter one. Mm-hmm. And then let's talk about, so half the time. So on my website, I have 4 hours of videos of me teaching through the book of Ruth. And usually the first half hour is asking a summary question to get into the content. Mm-hmm. And the second half hour is, all right, how do we apply it?
Yeah.
And some practical question. So that's kind of the style that I've developed, and I try to read good commentaries and make it as practical as possible.
Yeah, that's interesting you talk about that style, because I think we can swing the pendulum too far either way. Often mm-hmm. we think, oh, let's just get the context. But then we act like it wasn't preserved for us for any other reason besides just understanding what life was like and who received these words, right? Or we can swing the other way and say that, no, it's just all about me and my life right now.
Right.
It's just about application. But instead, you kind of have that hermeneutical principle that, no, it was written for both, and we have to understand how to put those pieces together. That's rightly dividing the word of truth. It's not just one or the other. It's both.
It's a good point, because some people, they come up, they read it, and they start applying it, and they're great applications, but they have nothing to do with the passage.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the medieval church, right? We were just like wild allegory. Like, well, this means this. It's like, no, I don't think it does.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do think we need both.
Yeah.
And, I think as we go through and really learning the whole Bible and getting a foundation, I think is important as well. For instance, if you read and studied one chapter 3 times a week.
Okay.
Let's say I gave you a study guide. You would read the chapter and just maybe read one page, because the study guides are pretty short.
Okay.
And it just gets you to think about it, maybe have some background, then apply it. If you did that 3 times a week, in 7.5 years, you would study the whole Bible.
Mm, that's good. Wow.
And what?
I mean, I can't do the math in my head. I'll take your word for it, but that's cool.
Now, if you did it once a week, it would take you 22 years. So I think one thing that we fall short that maybe I feel called to do is to encourage churches to study the whole Bible, mm-hmm. to look at, you know, to read through a whole book of the Bible and really think about it. You know, think about genre, think about how do I approach this, and then, you know, how do I apply it? The ministry is called Transformation Bible Ministries, because when I was a young Christian, after I became a believer, and I think right before med school, I went to a Christian work study program, and I was really studying the Bible with other people for the first time in my life.
Oh, cool.
And my small group leader was worried about me. He thought I was going to burn out. Because I would come up with 10 to 20 applications of every section that we studied. He was like, you're going crazy. What are you doing? I said, you don't understand. This is all new to me, and it's life-changing. Like, I would weep and repent as I was studying the Bible. I still do.
Yeah.
But as a young Christian, it was all new to me. And he said, take it easy. Like, you don't need to do all that. I said, yes, I do.
But I just want to interject there because that's really, I think, a lifeblood for churches to have people like that. New converts are wonderful things, because are wonderful people, not just because of, you know, what they do for us, but who they are. But really, all those of us that have been in church for a long time, we can often get we keep digging deeper, not just into the Word, but into our own traditions and our own selves, right? Instead of like, oh, that's right, God is making new creations all around us in human beings. He's saving people. He's bringing them from the domain of darkness to the kingdom of his beloved son all the time. And when you're around people like that, that are that hungry for the word, it's really invigorating, you know? And that I want our people, at least at our church, and really, you know, Reformed churches in general, to have that shot of adrenaline in the arm, like new people coming to faith it's an exciting thing. It's not, it shouldn't be rare, you know?
Yeah, and even older people that are not used to applying the word and being transformed can be encouraged when you have people, younger people around, or just somebody that is asking very practical questions and getting them to think. I've seen many people that went to different churches, not here, because we're very sensitive to those kind of things. But I've been in churches where there were people that were Christians for a long time. They may even know the Bible some, but they never really thought about it as practically to the point where they were being changed by it. Mm. And so in a way, that's hindering our maturation process if we're not doing that.
Yeah.
And so I just want to encourage people and small groups and churches to get a foundation of the whole Bible. You know, study the whole Bible, get a basic foundation, and then build upon that. Then you can go deeper, you can study in more depth. But there's a lot of illiterate Christians that don't really know the Bible. One thing I do, I teach every other week over at Wheeler Mission, and I just said to them, and I just had a little practice with one of my brothers who's not a believer. We were in Hawaii recently, and we were talking about the gospel. I hadn't really talked with him about it in quite a while, but from our Jewish background, I said, Mike, do you even know the history of the Old Testament? Mm-hmm. He said, not really. I haven't really looked at it since we were kids. And I said, in 5 minutes, I'll give you the history of the Old Testament. Mm. Just bare bones,
sure.
You know, basic major landmark, things, major events and timetable and just a basic outline. And so I did it also at Wheeler Mission this week. And a lot of guys either didn't know the Old Testament or they didn't have a good semblance. Because we're going through Revelation. It's not the first book that I started with. It's about the fifth.
Okay.
But because we did Daniel, they started begging me to do Revelation.
Yeah.
So we're about halfway through. And in Revelation chapter 10, the angel, who is really Jesus in that particular scene, because it's tied in with chapter 1, he says, go ahead and take the scroll and eat it. Mm-hmm. Well, it harkens back to Ezekiel, the end of chapter 2 and 3, where Ezekiel is told the same thing. And I just said, Jesus, he tells John, you know, you're going to have, it's going to be sweet in your mouth, but sour in your gut. Mm-hmm. But in Ezekiel, God says to him, it's only going to be misery and sorrow. Mm-hmm. There's no positive sweetness there. So I said, why do you think John is quoting this from Ezekiel and what's going on here? And they started figuring out, well, the sweetness is the gospel. Mm-hmm. And Ezekiel was in the midst of the exile with a rebellious people that didn't want to hear the good news.
Right.
And so he only had judgment to share with them, whereas now we have not just to warn people of judgment, but we have the good news of salvation. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up talking about where Ezekiel fit into Old Testament history, mm-hmm. as well as talking about the gospel. And they were just so encouraged. And I was so encouraged. Mm. I was like, I want to do this every day. Take me back here.
Soon, year and a half. And you're already doing it, which is great. I mean, I love to hear that you're already doing what you're hoping to do in retirement. You'll have more time and more resources at that point. So are you going to... is your plan to finish the study guides for every book, or do you plan to get on the road and teach? Or like, what do you think your ministry is going to look like?
Yeah, my plan is to do study guides in every book, but at the rate I'm going, it's going to take me another 20 years. So, and we never know how long we have.
Right.
So, we're getting a board together.
Okay.
And we'll raise a little bit of funds so that, if we have to do some traveling or do things for ministry. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to just transition into that. And, you know, I think I'm going to need help along the way. I'm going to need subject matter experts. I think we'll do some conferences. We'll do now some virtual meetings. Mm-hmm. I used to think, you know, we would get an office, but I don't see as much a need now
post-COVID
for doing that. Keep our expenses down. I think we could do a lot of virtual meetings, small groups, conferences, seminars. I'll be more freed up. You know, we could do a book over 3 days or even a week, mm-hmm. especially, you know, if you have retired people or people that don't have to go to work the next day. So I don't fully have it figured out. I just kind of know what the next step is and see how the Lord works there.
That's cool. When your wife's on board, I'm assuming.
Yeah, my wife is from a much different background as a Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah.
But she's a committed Christian. She's excited about the Bible. I think she wants me to continue in medicine a little longer because she knows I'm fairly young still. I'm just in my early 60s.
Yeah.
But I said, sweetheart, I've been planning this for many years.
Yeah.
And she's supportive. She understands.
She's great. I've enjoyed getting to know her over the last few years. Diana's awesome.
Yes.
Cool. Well, this is exciting. I'm encouraged for you. I'd love to hear the trajectory that God has had you on.
Thank you.
I mean, what would you go back and tell your 21-year-old self going into med school? Like, if you could tell your younger self something, whether as a Christian or just as a doctor, what do you think?
Dear younger me, like the song.
Yeah, dear younger, yeah.
Yeah, I often think, I think I would go back and exhort myself a little bit.
Okay.
And say, Dave, it's not about you, it's about Christ.
Mm.
And as you mature, you're going to learn that the more that you forget about yourself, the more that you can become like Christ, the more you can learn and apply his word and keep repenting, the more encouraged you will be.
Hmm.
In the beginning, I'd say the first 10 years, plus or minus, I was always fearful, worried the Lord's not going to use me, worried that somehow I would fall away.
Hmm.
I was just starting to learn kind of the Reformed understanding of the gospel that, it's all of God. Salvation is of the Lord.
That's right, yeah.
And that he chose me, not because of anything in me.
Yeah.
It's all the goodness of God. And so as I was learning about the gospel and taking a bunch of gospel courses, I cried because I realized still my communication wasn't good. I wasn't a very gracious person.
Mm.
I said, how can I know the gracious gospel if I'm not gracious?
Mm.
Like, what have I not gotten? What's the misconnection here?
Mm.
And I just started repenting. And I said, what I need to do is repent and learn to apply biblical principles and learn to pray and learn to walk in the Spirit. And then I will become slowly more and more gracious. And I still remember, it's usually been one or two women along the way. Every once in a while, the Lord would have someone come up and say, you're just such a kind, gracious, gentle person. And I think, it is the Lord. Because I'm not naturally that way at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the Lord's encouraged me, but I think I would exhort my 21-year-old self to walk with the Lord, to rest in him and realize that it's about him and he's got you, like you're going to be okay.
Yeah, and your 21-year-old self would probably say, yeah, but you're going to be a chief medical officer and a chief of staff and you're going to have a great career, but it's not about that. That's just something that God is using. As Martin Luther would say, that's God's mask that he uses to heal people, to feed people, to get people on the path towards wholeness and... that's what God has done through your life.
Yeah. I mean, if I said that to my 21-year-old self, my 21-year-old self would say, you are crazy. I don't have any desire to do anything like that.
I think most of our 21-year-old self need to not come back. Yeah. So I agree. Mine was, it's not about me, but yeah, I agree. It's 21-year-old self isn't exactly all that wise.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's cool. Well, thanks, Dave, for being here. This was super encouraging for me. And I'm looking forward to how God uses you in the coming years.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Appreciate it.
You bet. Maine and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana, at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.